From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. When Justice Christine Durham started practicing law in Utah in 1973, there weren't a lot of women in the field, so you can imagine the reaction she got from the men. A lot of comments like, "You're pretty good at this for a woman." Even Governor Scott Matheson, when he interviewed her to become a judge, asked about her childcare situation. One Chief Justice of the state Supreme Court at the time said a woman would serve in his court over his dead body. Well, he was still alive when Durham became a justice. He stayed, but so did she, for 35 years. 10 of them she served as Chief Justice. Durham has retired now, and today in the program she's joining us to talk about her life and the experiences that gave her perspective as a judge. Join us after the news.
Support for this Radio West podcast comes from Primary Children's Hospital. They've been recognized by U.S. News and World Reports for care in all 10 pediatric specialties, including cardiology, orthopedics, neurology, and cancer treatment. Primary Children's Hospital, the child first and always.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Yesterday, I had a conversation with Christine Durham. She stepped down earlier this month from the state Supreme Court after 35 years, 10 of those she was Chief Justice. Friends and observers of the court say her tenure will be marked by her commitment to legal education, to criminal justice reform, to providing opportunities and a role model for women in the law. But when we spoke yesterday, we didn't really spend a whole lot of time talking about her firsts or her legacy, not much on case law or her judicial philosophy either. We talked about her life and the books and the places and the stories that inspired her to commit her life to the law. So this may be an odd place to start. Your mother eloped and married her high school sweetheart.
That's right.
And then didn't last so long. She got pregnant.
Right.
Divorced him.
And you Well, actually, it was World War II when he got drafted
and
sent to basic training, and they were separated. Actually, they were separated at the time the divorce occurred. And in fact, my father met someone else while he was at basic training in San Francisco. So that kind of had an effect on things.
Yeah. Well, you were adopted by your stepfather.
That's correct.
And I have to say, I wonder if being adopted, does that mean anything significant to you? I mean, sometimes it raises questions. You knew you were with your birth mother, of course, but a lot of times it raises questions about identity and makes people wonder about, you know, physical characteristics, some of the characteristics that they, intellectual characteristics, traits, those kinds of things. Did that have any marking on you at all?
It did, but they were complicated times. My mother had been extremely hurt by the divorce, and she refused all of her life to ever talk to me about my father. I met him once, briefly for lunch in L.A. before our family moved to Washington, D.C., and then I met him again years later after we'd moved west. I went up to visit him and his wife in Concord, California, but by then he was so disabled by multiple sclerosis that he couldn't really speak. And so I spent an entire lifetime not knowing much about him. I've met my half-siblings from his second family, and they also are not terribly forthcoming about their lives with him. So yes, I think for me it has always been a question, in what ways am I like him? In what ways perhaps are my children like him? But I know so little about him and his life that it's always been quite frustrating.
One thing I've heard is that you had learned at some point that he was something of a skeptic.
Yes.
Did you inherit that?
I think I did.
Really?
I think I did. Yes. I understand that he was not one who was, I think, deeply in touch with his feelings. I'm not sure about that because I didn't know him, but just a couple of stories I've heard. And I don't think that's so much my problem, but he was very non-religious, for example, and apparently not particularly spiritually grounded.
Yeah.
And it's possible that I may have, if religiosity is a genetic trait,
yeah,
it's possible I got some of it.
Your parents broke it to you that you were adopted when you were 12.
Correct.
It doesn't seem like it was a terribly thoughtful way of going about it. I mean, they just dropped it on you, I guess. No context, no backstory. Just like, you're adopted, Christine. Is that it?
That was pretty much it. It was precipitated by the fact that we were planning to move across country. And this was in 1957, so a move across country was a long distance. And what had precipitated it was that my paternal grandmother, whom I had not known was my grandmother, but visited and kept in touch with our family and with me, had let her son know that we were moving. And he contacted my parents and asked for permission to meet me. Yeah. And so they acquiesced in that, which I think they deserve credit for.
Sure.
So they had to sit down and explain to me this meeting that was forthcoming.
Wow. But
well, and it
what was that like?
Well, it was so bizarre. It was just weird.
Yeah.
Because I, again, you mentioned context. There really was no context. I didn't know anything about what had caused the divorce. I didn't know why he'd never asked to see me before. I had no idea what was going on, and the signals from my parents were such that I knew it was not going to work to ask any questions.
Yeah. So just drop it.
Yep. And again, that was in the 50s,
that
I
was
think.
It.
That was it.
Yep, that was it.
In that era, people often never told their children they were adopted.
Yeah, it's true. You've mentioned that books were important in your family growing up. Your father would bring books back from work trips and... I think you had an aunt who was a librarian.
Yes, and she specialized in children's literature, and she kept us supplied with all of the – I mean, no, I had Winnie the Pooh when I was five, and it was a great richness of children's classics, and I loved to read. It was my major escape. It was the way I always found solace, shelter in the world.
It's interesting you say escape, and I wondered what that means, escape from – I guess I wondered if you ever found, like a lot of smart, independent young people, that you found your comfortable suburban life, you know, confining, or your parents boring, or maybe there was something about your Mormon faith that you came to later in life that was confining. Well, escaping from what?
That's an interesting question. From whatever it was about my life that I found confining. And I had a happy childhood. I had a wonderful education as a youngster. Public schools in California in the 50s were very good places for education. But I perceived my life to be quite confined. Hmm. You know, we didn't have a lot of money. We didn't, we traveled, but it was camping at the beach and so on, which I loved.
Yeah.
But books were the way that I discovered how wide the world was and how I could journey there and identify with the developmental issues of the characters that I was watching. I also grew up, and I don't know if every child does, but I grew up having the odd sensation that I didn't really belong in my life. Mm-hmm. It was interesting when I did find out that I was adopted and that my siblings
that
were half-siblings. That made sense to me. Probably completely irrelevantly, but I thought, oh, well, maybe that's a reason I don't feel that I fit as well.
I love the story. Apparently, when a lot of kids were putting their food on their TV trays and watching TV, you were putting dinner on the TV trays and reading books?
That's correct.
I like that little twist.
Yeah, when my father would go out of town on business, my mother, who took us to the library really on about a weekly basis, and we'd all come home with a stack. And in the era when I was, you know, 10, 11, 12, 13, I'd always pick books for how fat they were, so spend a lot of time with them. But we were allowed to eat in the living room with our books and our meal.
You talked about really digging into the thick books, seeing how a character was developed. It just seems like you were really paying attention to the way this story was constructed, the way the words were put together. Is that right?
Yes, that is right. Obviously not in a very sophisticated way.
No, of course.
Because I didn't have any
background.
But
unconsciously, you were paying attention to it.
Well, I was. And throughout my early years, probably into my early teens, that was my ambition in life, to become a famous novelist.
Yeah.
And I ended up being a writer, but not that kind
of
writer.
No, a very different kind of writer. But it is interesting that you did want to write.
Yes.
And that seems like one of the things that you loved about being a justice was the writing?
The writing and the engagement with language.
Yeah.
Particularly in the law, language is the tool of your trade. And that harkens back to my childhood fascination with language. So there's a connection there.
Your father went to work at the Paris Embassy.
Yes.
And this is where, to me, as I'm looking at your life, there emerges what seems like one of the themes. So I'll be presumptuous to assume that this is a theme. But the idea of being an outsider seems like a theme in your life, or paying attention to the times when you were an outsider, seeing outsiders approach you at the bench. That seems like something important. Am I getting that right?
No, I think that that is true. And I'm trying to, as we're talking, I'm trying to identify where those connections may have started, because as long as I can remember, I've always tended to identify with the underdog. Mm-hmm. I remember having a bit of an epiphany years and years ago in a case we were hearing at the Supreme, at our court, which involved search and seizure and the stopping of a vehicle. And I realized that as we were talking, the five of us, the other justices on the court, by and large, identified with the police, their concerns, their degree of feelings of safety, et cetera, whereas I was identifying with the passenger and imagining myself in the passenger's shoes as opposed to imagining myself in the police's shoes. And that was really revelatory to me, because it was a concrete example of the sense in which I often had in my personal life and in my work of trying to identify with the outsider. So I think that that's probably is a theme. Of course, living in a foreign country gives you all kinds of experiences in that regard. Someone just sent me a copy of a little essay. I'm not sure if I wrote it or my co-editor. This isn't my high school newspaper, the American School of Paris, talking about life in a French village. And I was appalled.
about the quality of the writing or something?
No, the writing wasn't that bad, but the insights were pretty...
Well, you were young.
Very young.
Give yourself a break.
Very young. But it did remind me of the degree to which one is, in a foreign culture, at least in most cases, a perpetual outsider. I thought, for example, about staying in Europe, finishing my baccalaureate and going to a European university. But at least in France in the 60s, I came to the conclusion, even as a 17-year-old, that I would never be an insider in France to the degree that I could approach in the country of my birth. And that was one of the reasons I came back to the States for college.
One of your teachers wrote on a paper or something, she suffers greatly from her lack of French birth.
Yes, and she was a Spanish teacher.
That's former Utah Supreme Court Justice Christine Durham. She retired earlier this month after nearly 40 years on the bench. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking with Christine Durham, who has just retired from the Utah Supreme Court after nearly 40 years on the bench. Durham was the first woman to serve on the court. 10 years she served as Chief Justice. I want to ask you about when Mormonism came into your life. Your father was he converted first, I guess. Well, your mother comes from a Mormon ancestry.
That's right. Yes, she had actually, her family, she'd actually been baptized as a child, but she and her brother had not had any significant church activity growing up. And at the time she married my father, she had no connection.
Yeah. Dad he's auditing a Mormon bishop. The Mormon bishop takes a shine to him and sends the missionaries over.
Right.
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 And he jumps in.
Yeah, he really did. Not quickly, by the way.
Really? It took him a while.
He went through 2 years worth of Mormon missionaries.
Wow.
I don't think they'd stick with him that long these days.
What's it like growing up as a convert? Like you've talked about your father's zeal, and it seems like that is distinctive about converts, mm-hmm. is they
tend to be all in.
Yep.
I think a lot of sacrifice is required to make the changes in your life and to embrace something so distinctive and powerful as what people experience in Mormonism. And so, yes, and that...
How old were you when he converted?
I was 8.
Okay.
I was 8, so I was quite young.
Baptism age, right?
Baptism age. In fact, I was baptized during the first year he was a member of the church. And I both saw, you know, my father had been he didn't have any addiction problems, but he was a smoker and a drinker. And he and my mother were doing well, but they had a lot of struggles financially. He was going to school on the GI Bill, and she was working nights at Bank of America. And what I perceived, obviously somewhat unconsciously, but I perceived that the experience in the Mormon church really gave a core to their marriage and to their attitude towards family. I didn't always agree with their perceptions, and I didn't always enjoy the experience, but I understood it as a very good influence in the life of our family.
Does growing up in the household of a convert make your family more focused on the faith in some way, the rules in some way? Like, was it distinctive? I don't have anything to compare it to, but I wonder.
That's right. Nothing to compare it to. No child does. Well, the faith was significant. I mean, the introduction of patterns of prayer and worship into family life were significant. Ritual. Thank you. And then there was, and again, here the convert's zeal emerges. My father was very, very comfortable with the rules. And in those days, the rules were, you know, there wasn't just the word of wisdom and going to meetings. There was no playing cards, no drinking Coca-Cola, which it's interesting how people changed. My father died 3 or 4 years ago. In his mid-90s, and at the end of his life, his favorite drink was Diet Coke.
Yeah.
So things change. But it was a period of transition. The Mormon Church was emerging was attempting to emerge as a mainline religious institution in the United States. And a lot of things happened to consolidate, that were intended, I think, to consolidate that emergence and to solidify its identity. And that was very much part of our experience. At the same time, however, when we moved to France, the church was a very different experience. They're much more diverse, many more different. We attended services with French people and some immigrants and so on. So there was language diversity and background diversity and so on. So that gave me a whole different version of what the LDS doctrine could bring into the lives of people who embraced it.
You've said that even as an early teenager, you were skeptical. I want to quote you here. I want to get this right. I tend not to take as entirely received whatever is being taught or told.
That's true.
Right?
That was true for me as a teenager, even a young teenager. I recall thinking twice about things that were said over the pulpit or things that were said in religious classes. And throughout college, I continued that. It's interesting because I had, I think, a fairly deep emotional tie to the religion in which I was raised. I loved the music and some of the ritual, and I've always deeply admired the degree of community that's at the base of the Mormon church, especially oriented to family. But at the same time, I didn't agree. When I was in college, I attended mostly to see my husband because my husband has Mormon bones.
No doubt about it.
Yeah,
well,
we should say
when you had considered taking a break.
I had
from Mormonism entirely when you went to school.
I had,
and then comes George.
That's right. I was a little homesick, and I showed up at church. I met him the first day, and he's a remarkable human being. It's not that he does not share my intellectual concerns and many of the questions that I have. But he does have Mormon bones. His faith is instilled in every fiber of his being. And it's remarkable to me in many ways that we have worked out over a 50-year marriage a way in which we can coexist in the range of our interests and concerns.
So I'm trying to imagine there are moments when you are just frustrated or bothered by a bit of doctrine or something that happened at church that day, and your husband says, honey, let's talk this through. It's
right.
going to be
that's
fine.
That's a very good description of how things went. And sometimes we would just agree to let things go because the choice can become whether you're going to leave the institution or whether there are enough ties to hold you in.
Yeah.
And I believe deeply in the need that human beings have for some transcendence in their lives, for some sense of the importance and depth of human relationships in the context of a deeper purpose. And so I've managed to stay in.
Yeah.
There's a famous story you may remember who said it. Somebody once in an altercation with Brigham Young said, it's my church too, Brigham.
Yeah.
I'm not leaving. So
that's where you are.
That's pretty much where I am so far.
Yeah.
So far.
Well, I want to ask you about two things, actually, two particularly controversial, I suppose, doctrines or experiences within Mormonism. Now, one, I want to ask you about blacks in the priesthood. And what interests me about this story, as most people listening now will know, the LDS Church didn't give blacks the priesthood until 1978. So when you were in Northern Virginia with your family, when your family moved to – your father was working in Washington, D.C. You're in Northern Virginia. This was in 1957,
right, through like the late, 60, right.
So we're deep into the like Jim Crow in the South, and you said that there were these residual pockets of segregation going on in Northern Virginia where you were. How did your family and how did you respond to the ban on blacks in the priesthood and Mormonism?
You know, it's very interesting. At that age, so I was 12 to 14 during those years. And living in a very segregated society, but largely unaware of it because, you know, our neighborhood was white, our school was white. But I can remember encountering some racial, not so much racial slurs, but close from some of my Mormon friends. Young, very young people and so on, picking up on what they heard and being deeply offended about that and going to my parents and saying, what is this? And their response to me in some ways wasn't very helpful, but in some ways it was. They said, we agree with you. It's wrong. We don't know. And George and I had an experience when we were in college. We became acquainted with the mission president then was an apostle from the Mormon Church, and we had some encounters with him. Actually, the origin of the friction was over the Vietnam War. He gave a talk at a function in which he actually analogized the Vietnam War protesters to the peace movement before World War II. And that was so offensive to me. And so I disagreed with him, and I disagreed with him publicly. And
he basically called you all appeasers or whatever.
Yes, exactly. And we ended up having a private evening with him and his wife after all this tension sort of got resolved. And one of the things we talked about was the doctrine of blacks and the priesthood. And we asked him, what do you think about this? And his response was, I don't understand it. It's one of the things I have to put on the shelf. So, again, both a helpful and an unhelpful response. And that I have to say, was a day of great rejoicing for us, as for many others, when the church changed its policy. And we understand now, I think we understood then, or at least some of us did, that it was a function of a strain of racism in society which the church had bought into and could not extricate itself from until enough attitudes changed. And I've always wondered, one of the church presidents, it's probably President Kimball, talked about the fact that those kinds of policies don't get changed until people start asking for them to be changed so that hearts and minds can be changed. So that's a very problematic part of our history. We have never sufficiently apologized for it.
Yeah.
And for the pain that it caused in many settings. And, you know, that's one of the things that would have been easy to leave over.
I'm going to move on from religion
sure.
here, but I have to ask this one more question. The policy about same-sex couples who choose to marry being now labeled apostates, their children being kept from membership and other privileges of the church. It seems like there's a kind of a legal dimension here. So I do wonder how your mind is processing that as a Mormon and as a judge.
Well, there is a legal dimension because there's a constitutional right to marry. And it applies to all people and it applies to all couples. And so there's that is just beyond discussion at this period of time. And to be honest, and it's possible I'll get myself in trouble for saying this, but I think the church has made several missteps in this arena. I think it made a misstep in engaging in the way it did with the Proposition 8 undertakings in California, and I think this new policy has caused grief and alienation and misery that is unnecessary. And in my view, not entirely consistent with the way in which I think a Christian should be oriented to difference and to different choices. I realize I speak only for myself
of course,
that regard. But again, like the issue with denying access to the priesthood to black people in the semi-old days, I think this one, in the end, will turn out to have been misguided. Now, I realize that there are apostles and seers and revelators who don't agree with me, so we'll see.
You're not going to want to touch this, but it seems like a lot of the, I guess, legal, social questioning or reasoning that's going on through this is being done by a former state Supreme Court justice, Dallin Oaks.
That's true. My wonderful former colleague, someone I admire and respect and have great affection for, but we never saw completely eye to eye on the court. We still don't see completely eye to eye.
That's former Utah Supreme Court Justice Christine Durham. She retired earlier this month after nearly 40 years on the bench. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This week on Radio West Films, we have the latest short in our series on Gerda Saunders. A few years ago, Gerda learned she had a progressive form of dementia, and she's allowed us to follow her on this journey. But this latest film is not about Gerda so much. It's about Peter, her husband of 46 years. Because at some inevitable point, the story always shifts away from the person with dementia to the person watching them live through it. Go see it at radiowest.org. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with Christine Durham, who was appointed as the first woman to the state's Supreme Court in 1982 by Governor Scott Matheson. She served as Chief Justice from 2002 to 2012. Justice Durham retired this month. Her last official day on the bench was November 15th. Let me ask you about when you were in school. At what point did it occur to you to study law? Because I know this is fascinating to me. You studied religion at Wellesley.
I did.
I mean, and not only that, in fact, I have to read the title of your dissertation because it's fantastic. The Centrality of the Concept of Despair in the Work of Lauren Kierkegaard and Its Impact on Existentialism and Theology. That's terrific.
Well, again, you have to account for the wisdom of youth.
Of course.
Or the lack thereof. But I was fascinated by Soren Kierkegaard's work, the Fear and Trembling and the Sickness unto Death. And he explored the question of faith from a very particular point of view that just drew me in and fascinated me. He talked about the leap of faith and the willingness to live with ambiguity and uncertainty and still to exercise connection and faith. And that very much mirrored my own relationship with religion. And so that drew me in. And then a similar exploration was going on in existentialism, what Jean-Paul Sartre and the other French existentialists were, again, employing not in a religious context, but in a developmental context, saying you can't know.
Yeah.
Epistemology is a futile effort, and you can't know, but you have to live. You have to act, and you have to live. And so I saw those two phenomena, one on the secular side and one on the religious side, having a connection that I deeply enjoyed.
There's this group of four novels written by the British writer Alexander Durrell in the late 1950s. And they're fascinating. They're about love on one hand, but they're also kind of packed with relativity. There's kind of Einstein in here and Freud maybe a little bit. But each of these four novels takes on a different perspective,
voice,
like
the
different voice, right? And I know this was influential for you. The different ways in which human beings, as you've put it, construct their realities, all based on their own life experience, their own perspective. Talk about this, if you would, because the way we our own perspective, our own sense of reality, I have to say, it seems like your awareness of that seems like one of your greatest gifts as a judge.
I think, actually, that it was. I remember I had been fascinated by those books, the Durrell books, and I was invited to give, I can't remember whether it was a last lecture or, which I was very young to give, but something at the University of Utah, and I titled the speech, "The Truth, the Whole Truth, and Nothing But the Truth," which is part of the oath that we give to witnesses in court. And my experience on the trial court had really underscored the kind of literary experience I'd had in those novels, that it's not as if there is a truth that you can ever reconstruct after its occurrence with the examination or testimony of witnesses to it, because they will have filtered their experience of the event or the truth in question in so many multiple ways. And later I came to have yet another experience with that whole notion, which was when I began to work on the question of professional education. I was very active in judicial education in its earlier days, and actually worked with a number of people who came out of adult education generally to apply the principles of adult learning to professional education. And one of the things I learned from their literature was this developmental idea. We as human beings encounter facts or experiences and we interpret them in certain ways. But if we re-encounter those same facts and circumstances at a different level of cognitive, emotional, moral development, we will come up with something different. There's a wonderful story I used to use in teaching this about a little boy who was raised on a farm and asked his mother, you know, where do cows come from? And he was very young, and he just meant, where had they showed up on the road from?
Right.
But she gave him a talk about bovine reproduction. And he looked at her in absolute total shock and said, not on my farm. And, you know, he was too young to process that information. Obviously, 10 years later, 20 years later, that information would have a whole different context. And that's true of adult learning.
So how do you apply that as a judge? I guess you have to see the the question at hand as part of a continuum.
Exactly. And you also have to be willing to unpack the experience. You do get context. I mean, you may have 10 witnesses to a single event, and from that testimony, you can parse the probable likelihood of what happened, or at least an approximation of what happened. And you get used to doing that as a trial judge, and of course, that's what we ask jurors to do as well.
Yeah.
And it's a little bit different on the appellate level, because there you are often seeking not for the identification of facts, but for an understanding of the way complex legal ideas and principles and precedent will apply to what you hope is a fairly established set of facts. And that also is a constructive experience.
Yeah.
It's not that judges simply see the law and apply it. They have to see it and understand it and look at its origins to figure out what was intended in an existing fact situation. So, yeah, the combination of a focus on language and on constructing truth, I think, is at the heart of judging.
And then you throw into the mix the person themselves, often powerless.
And a judge's, as we were talking about earlier, a judge's perception of power and how it works in society and in relationships. Some of the work that I did early on the court was in domestic relations cases. And there was long precedent that sort of had embedded in it perceived gender roles. And my own experience was so different from some of the principles that were guiding these decisions. And I was able just to have the motivation and the interest to do the research and to identify different facts, different statistics, different projections of what reality was to the legal principles that we were identifying. And it's not that a man couldn't have done that, but a man might not have had the same perspective. I remember one case we had involving it was a very challenging case involving the value, the damages associated with having a child. This was a failed vasectomy. The wife had serious psychological problems, in fact, was schizophrenic, had to go off her medication to complete the pregnancy. And they sued for wrongful pregnancy. And of course, that's a very tough sell. And not one of my colleagues could even contemplate the notion that the birth of a child could be damaging to a woman and her husband. I, as a mother of five, could understand differently, at least. I don't know, understand better, but understand differently the burdens that the birth of a child and the raising of a child, particularly for someone with serious mental illness, could impose on a family. I lost that one. But at least, you know, there was a perspective there that came from a different life experience.
So I'm trying to figure out what's the trajectory of thinking? What's the line of thinking here from interest in Old Testament, high criticism of the Bible, Kierkegaard, and now, I'm going to go to law school. What was the connection?
Well, first of all, the work has a tremendous amount of overlap. I mean, that's lawyers do with secular laws what theologists do with religious law and history and precedent.
Yeah. Dig in.
So that's right. So the methodology and the urge to unpack the history, unpack the meaning, and examine the impact on human lives is very similar. But the other thing that was going on when I was in college was the civil rights movement. And I'm not sure exactly why, because I didn't know any civil rights lawyers. And I didn't even have any classmates or close friends who went down with the Freedom Riders or others. But that really kindled in me a sense of rightness and wrongness and fairness. And I identified lawyers as having potential to work on those issues of fairness and to vindicate the rights of people who were being disadvantaged. And I also had the experience of dating a few law students while I was in college, and I'd go to class with them, and it wasn't that I encountered any civil rights work in law school classes, but I did encounter discussions of language that I found absolutely fascinating. And several of those students weren't at all interested in the law, and in fact, some of them never even practiced afterwards, but I loved it. And so I thought that the other thing, of course, is what are you going to do with a female Mormon theologian? It's just not going to happen. So,
so in, I think it's 1973, you had graduated from law school. George, your husband, had graduated from medical school at this point, and you had the opportunity to come to Utah.
Correct.
Now, your mother, you've said, who came from Mormon ancestry, but her branch of the family decided Utah was not the promised
land. That's right, California.
So choosing to come to Utah, did you feel apprehensive about coming here?
I did feel apprehensive about coming here, but there were weights on all sides of the scale, because although I was nervous, frankly, about moving to a predominantly Mormon community, I had enjoyed being part of the diaspora and living abroad, so to speak. But on the other hand, my husband has a very large, close family here in Utah, and I was very fond of his parents. And I had grown up, our nuclear family was it, especially after we left California, virtually no associations with cousins or aunts and uncles, not that there were many to start with. My mother came from a very small family. But I was very attracted by the idea of bringing my children up in a community where they would have lots of cousins and aunts and uncles and feel part of a larger family. So our deal was to come. He had a 3-year residency, and our deal was to come for that 3-year residency and then to think about it, which, had we known, isn't the way it usually works.
Yeah.
Once you settle. Join a community and settle,
you
and your children start getting engaged, you stay.
Was it like practicing law? Before you get to the judge part, practicing law, there's the great stories. It sounds kind of humiliating, arguing before Stuart Hansen Sr.
Yes. He was a character, and he said whatever popped into his head. It's interesting, though, a good deal of the commentary, although it was very negative, disparaging, and
because you were a woman.
Because I was a woman, yes. Yeah. But at the same time, a lot of it was not maliciously oriented. It was good humored. Mm-hmm. And in that era, it's so interesting to revisit some of those experiences in the light of what's going on in the public discussion about sexual harassment today. Yeah. But it felt relatively comfortable for me to ignore, sort of put aside uncomfortable comments. Mm-hmm. Some of them stuck and some of them stung, but there was no place for recourse. I mean, to whom are you going to complain about a judge who's just made inappropriate comments to you in the courtroom?
Said you did a nice job
for a woman lawyer, right?
Yeah. There is a great story that you've told from Judge Willis Ritter.
Yes.
which was kind of demeaning but kind of funny. I don't know. Do you mind telling it?
Exactly. I was representing some plaintiffs who were suing the state tax division for sexual discrimination and sexual harassment. And Ritter had a calendar call. He used to do that, call everybody in town to sort of deal with motions, and we had a procedural motion and showed up. And after I entered my appearance and the other side had entered its appearance, he said, "Mrs. Durham, is this one of those goddamn women's lib bra burning cases?" And I was so taken aback. I was just absolutely startled. And I paused for a moment and I finally said, "Yes, Your Honor, I think it is." Whereupon he laughed and was just as nice to me as he could be. So it did work. It did work both ways.
When you were appointed by Governor Matheson to the Third District Court, And this was a big deal because this was the first woman serving on a court of general jurisdiction in the state.
That's correct.
But you've described your reception by the other male judges as, you've said, a little chilly. No one showed up. One man showed up for your swearing in.
From the court, yes. That's right. Judge David Winder, who was then on the 3rd District Court, went on to become a federal judge and a thoroughly wonderful human being. But I didn't know. It's hard looking back to know. It was definitely chilly. I mean, no one called to welcome me. No one called to offer me assistance. No one invited me out to lunch. But it's hard to know in retrospect whether that was targeted at me or whether it reflected a culture in that particular group at that particular time. There were a bunch of characters on that court at that particular time. I think we were 11 or 12 and some really interesting characters on that court.
But you have said you felt isolated and lonely.
I did. I felt very isolated because, among other things, my courtroom was across the street from the other courtrooms. I had a beautiful old courtroom in the old city county building, which no longer exists, but there were just two of us over there and everyone else was across the street in the main courthouse. So yes, it was very isolating, and I had interesting experiences. I had lawyers who told me they really didn't think a woman should be doing a judge's job. I had others who said the equivalent of, you know, you're not so bad for a woman.
Yeah.
And so that was interesting. But yes, I was disappointed in the lack of collegiality and camaraderie. And I look, for example, now at the 3rd District Court and the degree of collegiality that exists there. And I think they're very lucky.
I feel like we can't finish this interview without saying something about your husband, George. You've mentioned him, but you've called him your secret weapon. And it's interesting. You've talked about how this process of trying to negotiate, he having obviously a full career, you having and being very interested in having a full career, how you managed taking care of the kids. And you've said that in some cases he got more resentment for the role that he had played in parenting.
That's actually true. In the mid-70s, late 70s, even into the 80s, we joke about a time when he showed up at the PTA with a plate full of brownies for some event, and the female PTA president looked at him and said with a snarl, "I'll bet you even baked those yourself." And clearly what was coming through, I think, is her resentment that her husband was not in the same mold. And he had comments from neighbors and people in the carpool saying, "You're giving us all a bad name because of the degree to which you're engaged in parenting." That, of course, is much more common these days, and men take much more responsibility. What was so remarkable about him was he didn't have any role models for that. And yet we would talk about it, identify what we needed, and it came so naturally to him. He never resented those roles. He enjoyed his roles in parenting thoroughly. And I remember how pleased he was. His parents, I think, were quite worried about the enterprise we were launching. They were a very traditional couple, very successful, but very traditional. And I think they worried for his career. They thought his career might be stunted by my having a career. But I remember he shared with me that his father had commented to him, and they were together on one occasion when George was doing childcare, and his father had said, "You are a good father. You're a better father than I was." And I don't think that's really true. I think George had a wonderful father. But his father actually recognized and acknowledged the contribution he was making to the lives of our children.
That meant something to him.
It did.
I've heard the state Supreme Court, the process of oral argument is being described as a hot court. Hmm. Like that there was a lot of engagement, that the justices jump in and get to the questions. And I'm wondering what kind of a questioner were you? Were you withering? Were you pretty demanding? What was it like to argue a case when you were Chief Justice or on the bench?
Well, I like my colleagues, I was always prepared and engaged. I hope that I was never I think I was an aggressive questioner. I hope that I was never withering. I know that there are a few lawyers out there who believe that I pinned them to the spot too aggressively. I've had others respond and say how much they enjoyed oral argument there. But I always believed in, and there are differences of philosophy on this, but I always believed that oral argument belongs to the court, that we're being asked to answer questions that the parties have brought to us. And we come to the bench to oral argument. We know what the questions are. We know what the arguments of the parties are. We really want to use that time testing our theories and finding out what the sort of back against the wall positions of the lawyers are. And I know there were times when I went on too long and pressed too hard. But for the most part, I think I was experienced as a worthy part of the conversation. I hope that's true.
How do you think about legacy now? Do you even like that idea of legacy? People are wondering, oh, what's your legacy? And you seem awfully young to be talking about having a legacy as if you're going to go off into the sunset. But how are you thinking about all that these days?
That's an interesting question. I've certainly never in my years on the bench thought about having a legacy or about the notion that I was building a legacy. At the end of my judicial career, looking back, it does appear that there are arenas in which I brought things to the table. I think about state constitutional law as an example of one of those arenas.
Yeah.
That might not otherwise have gotten on the agenda when they did and as they did. And I'm really pleased about those accomplishments. I look back at some doctrinal developments and contributions that I made and feel quite pleased about the work that I did there and what I put into the stream of consciousness in terms of our precedent. In some ways, if I have a legacy, I suppose and I hope that it has at least been to help establish in the state of Utah that women lawyers and women jurists deserve and have a full place in the courts and in the profession, and that they are entitled to a seat at the table.
That's former Supreme Court Justice Christine Durham, who retired this month. Her last official day on the bench was November 15th. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Anthony Scoma. The program was directed today by Michael Havey. Radio West is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.